KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I can announce a ceasefire and a hostage deal has been reached between Israel and Hamas.
Celebrations erupted in Gaza and Israel after the announcement that Israel and Hamas had agreed to a six-week ceasefire and hostage deal. But now Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has postponed a cabinet vote to approve the ceasefire. We'll start in Gaza.
We are here happy with this victory because the Palestinian people simply want their freedom. Freedom for the Palestinian people. We don't want anything but freedom and to live with dignity without occupation.
We'll also speak to the Gaza-born Palestinian analyst Mohammed Shahada, former Israeli negotiator Daniel Levy, and journalist Jeremy Scahill. Plus, we look at the confirmation hearing for Pam Bondi, Trump's pick to be attorney general. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A long-awaited ceasefire deal in Gaza is being delayed after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu blamed Hamas for a last-minute crisis that's led to the postponement of his cabinet signing off on the deal. Hamas refuted Netanyahu's claims the group had backtracked on any aspects of the draft agreement. The deal, mediated by Qatar, Egypt, and the United States, was announced Wednesday, setting off celebrations throughout Gaza as Palestinians expressed joy, relief, and deep sorrow over the past 15 months of attacks. This is 14-year-old Ahmed Al-Athamna, who was displaced from his home in northern Gaza.
Enough with what happened to us. Enough with martyrs who are gone. Enough. It's enough. It is better to go back to our homes and sit in the rubble. This is better for us. It is easier for us instead of having martyrs every day.
Israel's war on Gaza, which UN experts, legal analysts, and many rights groups have concluded a genocide, has killed nearly 47,000 Palestinians since October 7, 2023, according to official counts. Another 110,000 Palestinians have been wounded, the true toll expected to be far higher. The ceasefire agreement, which is expected to go into effect on Sunday, January 19th, includes in its 42-day first phase, a cessation of attacks on Gaza, a surge of aid into the territory, the return of residents expelled from northern Gaza, and a limited prisoner exchange involving 33 hostages held by Hamas and some 1,000 Palestinian prisoners held by Israel. It also includes the withdrawal of Israeli forces from the most populated areas of Gaza and the opening of Gaza's Rafah crossing with Egypt. The terms of the deal are nearly identical to a ceasefire agreement that was advanced in May of last year by President Biden. Since the deal was announced Wednesday, Reuters reports Israel has killed at least 70 more Palestinians in Gaza, including an overnight strike on Gaza City.
Overnight, they hit a house where 35 martyrs were killed. We urge the mediators who brokered this truce to hurry up making it come into effect. For it to be today is better than making it tomorrow. For it to be at 7 is better than making it at 8, because there are martyrs every hour. We lose homes every hour.
At least 20 people were killed in an Israeli attack on Jabalia earlier today. Many others remain trapped under the rubble. There are also reports more health workers have been killed since the ceasefire was announced, including Dr. Hala Akram Abu Ahmed, who treated patients at Al-Ahli Arab Hospital. We'll have more on the ceasefire after headlines. In Washington, D.C., Pam Bondi, Trump's nominee for attorney general, vowed not to politicize the Justice Department as she faced questioning by the Senate Judiciary Committee Wednesday. But when repeatedly pressed by Democratic senators, Bondi refused to commit to maintaining independence from President Trump and his possible request to prosecute journalists or other perceived threats. She also refused to rule out investigating special counsel Jack Smith or former Congressmember Liz Cheney. Pam Bondi also also avoided directly answering questions about Trump's vow to pardon January 6 defendants and refused to say Trump had definitively lost the 2020 election. We'll have more on Pam Bondi's hearing later in the broadcast with journalist David Dayan. Florida Senator Marco Rubio, Trump's pick for Secretary of State, also faced a confirmation hearing Wednesday, receiving a warm welcome from his fellow senators as he expressed support for NATO, backed Trump's America First approach to foreign policy and diplomacy, and repeatedly warned of threats posed by China, which he called a dangerous near peer adversary.
If we don't change course, we are going to live in a world where much of what matters to us on a daily basis, from our security to our health, will be dependent on whether the Chinese allow us to have it or not. That's an unacceptable outcome.
Activists with Code Pink disrupted Rubio's hearing. As they were removed from the session, protesters yelled, quote, Marco Rubio's sanctions are killing kids in Nicaragua, Cuba, and Venezuela, unquote. They also condemned his staunch support of Israel, shouting out, quote, you can't be a warmonger and a diplomat, unquote. Four other Trump nominees face Senate confirmation hearings Thursday. White House Budget Director nominee Russell Vogt, who indicated plans for major spending cuts, one of the architects of Project 2025. John Ratcliffe for head of the CIA. Sean Duffy, a climate crisis denier for Transportation Secretary. And Chris Wright, Trump's pick for Energy Secretary. Wright is a fracking executive who vowed in his hearing to implement plans to expand fossil fuels by Trump. The climate group Sunrise Movement said 10 activists were arrested as they disrupted Wright's hearing on Wednesday. Protesters held a sign reading, Oil CEO's profit, L.A. burns, unquote. During his hearing, Chris Wright said he stood by past comments linking wildfires and climate change is hype. ExxonMobil has filed a lawsuit against California Attorney General Rob Bonta and environmental activists after they accused the fossil fuel giant of carrying out a decades-long campaign of deception that caused and exacerbated the global plastics pollution crisis. Exxon is the world's largest producer of single-use plastic. In its legal counterattack, the company accuses Bonta of making false statements about its advanced recycling technology. This comes after Bonta and four environmental groups, including the Sierra Club, sued ExxonMobil, alleging the fossil fuel giant spent decades promoting plastics recycling, even though many plastic products proved impossible to recycle at scale. House Speaker Mike Johnson on Wednesday abruptly removed Ohio Republican Congressmember Mike Turner as chair of the House Intelligence Committee, saying it was time for a fresh start during the new Congress. Turner later told CBS the shakeup came due to, quote, concerns from Mar-a-Lago. Turner's an outspoken military hawk and has advocated for continued U.S. military support for Ukraine. In January of 2021, he broke with his party and voted to certify Joe Biden's presidential victory. President Biden delivered his final Oval Office address Wednesday evening, warning Americans of growing threats to democracy and a, quote, dangerous concentration of power.
Today, an oligarchy is taking shape in America of extreme wealth, power, and influence that literally threatens our entire democracy, our basic rights and freedoms, and a fair shot for everyone to get ahead.
President Biden did not name Trump or Elon Musk, but warned about a tech industrial complex and an avalanche of misinformation and disinformation. In Ukraine, gunfire echoed over the presidential palace in Kyiv earlier today as Ukrainian air defenses fired on a Russian drone buzzing overhead. The incident came as Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky held talks with visiting UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer, who agreed to send further military assistance to Kyiv as he signed a so-called 100-year partnership treaty with Ukraine. Their meeting came a day after Ukraine's military said it had launched its largest attacks yet on Russian soil, prompting retaliatory threats from Moscow. Since November, Ukraine has increasingly been using U.S.-made ATACMS missiles and British Storm Shadow missiles to strike deep inside Russian territory. Meanwhile, the Biden administration Wednesday imposed new sanctions on hundreds of Russian entities and individuals accused of supporting Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The executive order requires Congress to be notified before any of the sanctions can be lifted, a move that legal experts have called Trump-proofing. The UN's human rights chief back growing calls for the U.S. and Europe to lift sanctions on Syria as Syria rebuilds after the ouster of Bashar al-Assad. These sanctions were imposed shortly after the war in Syria broke out in 2011. As he visited Damascus Wednesday, Volker Türk also called for a national reconciliation process and warned outside parties against infringing on Syria's sovereignty.
The Human Rights Office of the United Nations will continue to support inclusive, nationally owned and nationally driven processes. There are still very real threats to Syria's territorial integrity, independence and sovereignty, which must be fully respected and rigorously upheld.
Earlier this week, six EU member states called for the temporary suspension of sanctions on Syrian transport, energy and banking as the bloc assesses a new policy towards Syria following the Assad regime's collapse. And in Haiti, the United Nations warns a surge of violence by armed groups has pushed the number of people displaced from their homes past 1 million. That's more than three times the number of people displaced this time last year. More than half of those uprooted by the violence are children. The UN's Human Rights Office reports that last year, gang violence across Haiti left more than 5,600 people dead. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. Celebrations were held in Gaza and Israel Wednesday after the announcement that Israel and Hamas had agreed to a six-week ceasefire and hostage deal. But now Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has postponed a cabinet vote to approve the ceasefire, which is opposed by some far-right members of Netanyahu's government. Netanyahu has said Hamas is demanding last-minute concessions, but Hamas has denied the claim. Qatari Prime Minister Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman Al Thani outlined part of the deal on Wednesday.
Qatar, the Arab Republic of Egypt, and the United States are happy to announce the success of joint mediation efforts in order to reach a deal between the parties of the conflict in the Gaza territory to exchange prisoners and hostages and a return to a prolonged truce that achieves a permanent ceasefire between the two sides, in addition to an agreement for the delivery of large amounts of humanitarian relief and aid to the Palestinian Brothers in the Gaza Strip.
President Biden said the deal is based on the ceasefire plan he outlined last May. In recent weeks, the Biden administration worked with representatives from the incoming Trump administration to negotiate the ceasefire deal, which is scheduled to begin on Sunday, the last full day of Biden's presidency. Under the terms of the deal, Hamas would release 33 Israeli hostages over the next 6 weeks, with the first hostages being released on Sunday. In exchange, Israel will release 1,000 Palestinians imprisoned in Israel over the six-week period. The deal also calls for Israel to pull back its troops from populated areas of Gaza and for Israel to allow 600 aid trucks into Gaza a day.
This comes as authorities in Gaza say Israel's killed at least 81 Palestinians over the last 24 hours. The official death toll in Gaza is nearing 47,000. But just last week, the Lancet Medical Journal said the actual toll may be 40% higher. We're joined now by Shruk Ela, an independent journalist and producer in Gaza. Her husband, the journalist Roshdi Siraj, was killed in an Israeli airstrike in October of 2023. He ran Ein Media, which Ela now heads. In 2024, Ela received the International Press Freedom Award from the Committee to Protect Journalists. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Shruk. If you can start off by talking about the response on the ground to the announced ceasefire, even though the Israeli government has now put off a cabinet vote on it.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for having me today. I'm happy to share this with you today over the news of yesterday, the announcement of the ceasefire. You know, it's just an announcement. It's not officially happening on the ground. The effect of this is gonna take place on Sunday. But even though the people here are celebrating, they are happy that there is, you know, a baby step for their healing process, for going forward, like in the future, which is, you know, it's just all about the uncertainty. So I can tell the feelings here is such a mix of feelings. You can see people smile. smiling and crying at the same time.
We can hear you fine, Shrook. We can hear you.
Okay. Perfect. Sorry, the power went off. So what I was talking that all of the people were celebrating and crying at the same time. This is a moment that all of us, like plus 2 million people, have been waiting for this moment, for this announcement. And yet, we believe it's still, we have like 2-3 days left to be killed in a, and the bloodshed is not stopping since the announcement until this moment, plus 70 people got killed. Massacres are everywhere, especially in the north, the northern part of the Gaza Strip. We were able to hear the bombardment that happened in the north, even in the south and the central part of the Gaza Strip. Some people in the West Bank, they also hear those high explosion, those high explosions in the north. But I can tell you that people are happy, and also they are, you know, that mix between heartbreak and relief. So this is exactly what we are living, because there's that sense of uncertainty of the future. Nobody knows what the future holds for him or her, especially those who are displaced now and waiting for the implementation of this ceasefire, so they can return to their homes, or what left of their homes in the north. So there is that kind of uncertainty. You cannot guarantee, or you cannot decide what do you want. And it is. I can give it from a personal perspective as well. I'm part of this society. I'm a story as the stories of those of this society as well. So, but at least we are so grateful that we reached this moment, and there is the step forward, and there is a ceasefire, and hopefully it will last more, and it will be really implemented on the ground.
Shrook, could you respond, though, to the fact that the Netanyahu government has now delayed a cabinet vote on the ceasefire? Are you confident that it will still go ahead?
Like, despite the delays that happens by the Netanyahu's government, I still believe it will happen. And we are on the track, and like we have seen this before, like it happened. That is because of the pressure of the President Trump, and we, like, it's been almost over 1 year under the presidency of Biden, and not having on the ground to stop this madness. But by expecting the presidency of Trump, this is a real step here that we all of us are seeing, and the President Trump, he already put pressure both on both sides, the Israelis and the Palestinians as well. So I believe those delays that Netanyahu is trying as much as he can to get advantage of whatever moment or minute left for him in the government. But yeah, I think we are on the track, and we are going for the implementation of the ceasefire.
Shrook, I want to play an extremely emotional clip. While reporting from Gaza on news of the ceasefire yesterday, the Al Jazeera journalist Anas al-Sharif took off his helmet and vest like you're wearing, that's Mark Press, while he was on air. This is what he said.
ممكن أن نخلع هذه الخوذة ميادة التي أرهقتني طوال هذه الفترة.
Now I can take off this helmet that was weighed on me, and also this vest that has been part of my body throughout this long period.
والذي كان على مدار الوقت يرافقني والآن نعلن هنا.
And now we are announcing from inside Gaza City, this news, a ceasefire for the citizens and the whole population of Gaza that has faced a genocidal war, has faced bombings, explosions, and forced displacement. In this place where I am standing, I will dedicate this to Ishmael Al-Ghul, who would be standing here in my place announcing this news. To pay tribute to our colleague Ishmael Al-Ghul, we remember our colleague Rami Al-Rifi, we remember our colleague Samer Abu Dhaka, Hamza Dahdu, and also our precious friend who was always holding the frame, Fadi Al-Wahidi.
Al Jazeera journalist Anas al-Sharif soon put his press vest and helmet back on. He then posted on X, quote, an hour ago, I was documenting the joy of the people of Gaza over the news of the ceasefire, but the Israeli occupation, as usual, continues to commit massacres and kill joy in people's hearts, as he dealt with a number of people who had been killed soon after in Gaza. Shruk Ela, as we wrap up, your final thoughts from Gaza in this first period, if this does go through, you're expressing the thoughts of what most people are saying now, that even with the Israeli delay, that it will go through. The first phase, 33 hostages to be released, 3 female hostages on day 1, 4 more on day 7, 26 more over the next 5 weeks. In exchange, Israel will release around 1,000 Palestinians and allow the entry of 600 trucks carrying humanitarian relief into Gaza daily. What this all will mean?
Well, it means that for us, as we are displaced here, like over 1 million people are displaced in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. And even those who are living in the north, for example, they are already displaced in other parts because of that, you know, the lots of the evacuation orders that the army issued several times, and they are still issuing this. And they already issued the an evacuation order in the, before the announcement in 2 hours. So it is a moment of realization for all of us. Like we, eventually we are getting more close to that moment to be firstly accepting the reality of that, that there is another war that is just waiting for us after this war, because of the there is the war of uncertainty, there is a war of rebuilding, the war of the people who already left us, and the memories that we left as well. So, and you know, like the majority of the people in Gaza are struggling with grief, trauma, and other, you know, other psychological aspects. And I can say that having this step, it will be a real action for us, like to do something. It's been like almost 15 months of being on hold, everything, like our feelings, our days. Like I can tell, like today, I'm feeling that I'm getting back to the 8th of October. So I, yeah, the genocide started on the 7th of October. We have never seen the 8th of October till the moment of the announcement of this ceasefire. So I can tell that now we are still stuck back with 2023, the 7th of October, and we're living now the 8th of the 7th of the October. That means that how time is stopped with those people here because of agony. They are singing in agony and they grieve over everything, literally everything. What I mean, nobody here has lost nothing. Like if your home is still standing, your beloved ones, friends, whatever, they are still with you. You are not losing your source of income, but yet you lost your hope in humanity. You lost your insecurity as well. You lost that sense of insecurity. And the let me say that the education in terms of the kids who already lost 2 academic years in a row because of the ongoing genocide. So everyone lost something here, and nobody, we are celebrating, but it doesn't mean we are celebrating out of joy. We are celebrating out of grief, because eventually we will have that moment to break down, to give that a chance to deal with our hardships and our problems that occurred during this genocide.
Shruk Ela, independent journalist in Gaza. In 2024, she received the International Press Freedom Award from the Committee to Protect Journalists, speaking to us from Deir al-Balah. When we come back, we go to the Gaza-born Palestinian analyst Mohammed Shahada, the former Israeli negotiator Daniel Levy, and journalist Jeremy Scahill. Stay with us. موطني
الجمال والجلال والسناء والبهاء في رباه في رباه والحياة والنجاة والهناء والرجاء في هواه في هواه. هل أراك سالما منعما وغانما مكرما سالما منعما وغانما مكرما هل أراك في علاك تبلغ السماك تبلغ السماك موطني موطني.
Homeland performed by Mohammed Youssef. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
To talk more about the ceasefire and hostage deal in Gaza, we're joined now by three guests. Mohammed Shehada is a writer and analyst from Gaza. He's chief of communications at Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor. He joins us from Copenhagen. Jeremy Scahill is co-founder of DropSite News. And Daniel Levy is president of the U.S. Middle East Project and a former Israeli peace negotiator under Prime Ministers Ehud Barak and Yitzhak Rabin. So, Daniel, I'd like to begin with you. If you could just start by responding to Netanyahu delaying the cabinet vote and what you think the cause of that is, in particular, the pressure on him from right-wing members of his coalition.
Right. So what we're led to believe is that the proximate cause, in other words, the what the media in Israel is being background briefed on, I'm not sure if they're saying it publicly yet, is that this has to do with the lists of prisoners that would need to be let go by Israel, the Palestinian prisoners. There are thousands of Palestinian prisoners often held in detention without trial in Israeli prisons. And this has to do with the names that Hamas is insisting will be on that list. We don't know whether this will torpedo things or not. What we do know, and let's stick with that, is that Netanyahu didn't want to get to this moment. You can listen to the lies of the outgoing administration, of Secretary Blinken. You know, sometimes in a negotiation, it's useful to have some constructive ambiguity. One of the mediators may even have to align with the narrative of one of the parties to give them that victory narrative, even if they haven't got the victory, to get a deal over the line. But there's also a kind of lie, which is just a lie, and it undermines things. And we've been told throughout that the problem is Hamas. That's the reason there's no deal. But every Israeli journalist who's been serious, who's covered this, and it's rare to have unanimity there, from left and right, pro and anti Netanyahu, have acknowledged that Netanyahu worked hardest to prevent this deal, and Netanyahu has changed under the pressure of a president who's perceived to be someone who can act like the leader of a superpower, who Netanyahu can't wrap around his little finger like he could with Biden. That's the circumstance in which Netanyahu has found himself being dragged into a deal that threatens his domestic political stability. He wants to continue with this war, and therefore Netanyahu will do everything today. And I imagine if we move forward throughout the period of implementation, and as one tries to get further down the road, he will do everything to torpedo this, hoping that it will be easy. Given narratives that exist in the West, it will be easy to say, look, you see, Hamas are the ones who are to blame. That's the fragility of this thing. That's where Netanyahu is. And that's what we're having to contend with in these very hours.
And explain what the objections are of Bezalel Smotrich as well as Ben-Gvir, and explain what it would mean if one of them left. Smotrich said he will not approve this. And if both of them left, will Netanyahu survive as prime minister?
Okay, let's do the coalition math first, if I may. Smotrich or Ben-Gvir, if one of those leaves, and Ben-Gvir is the one who has, his faction has set this out more clearly, That on its own, if they left the government and even voted against the government, would not bring down the coalition. Together, if they left and voted against the government, that brings down the coalition. They can certainly leave and say that they are leaving because of this deal, but if Netanyahu reverses the terms, then they will return, or that they will leave, but they will hold their fire in terms of bringing down the coalition. And I think that's probably, that's the ballpark in which we are. The opposition will offer a safety net over the implementation of the deal. They won't offer a general safety net. What all this adds up to, without boring people with the intricacies of Israeli coalition math, what all this adds up to is that Netanyahu has a political problem if he moves forward with this. And it's one of the main reasons, there were other things, but it's one of the main reasons he did not want to go to a deal. But his problem is that that was only sustainable when domestic pressure was the only factor, if there was no significant external pressure. The only actor that can bring significant external pressure is the US, because the US offers the weapons, the arms, the political, diplomatic, economic cover. Israel couldn't do this for a day without the US. The Biden administration refused to use that leverage. Why are the coalition allies from the extreme right against this? The point is very simple. Their vision, and it is a vision shared by many in the Israeli media, by many in Netanyahu's own party, and it is the vision that, let's face it, Netanyahu himself has pursued for most of this assault on Gaza. The vision is that Gaza will be shrunk. Ultimately, the Nakba will be continued, the removal of Palestinians, that Israelis will resettle in Gaza, and it's part of a broader vision of the permanent denial of rights, dispossession, and removal from the physical expanse that began with the Nakba. Why are Gazans refugees in the first place? Of this particular Zionist vision. They see that if Palestinians are allowed back to the north, that if the Israeli military has to withdraw, these are all things that are part of an agreement, that vision will take a serious hit. And they look at this and they say, wait a minute, the Palestinians are still here. They're still standing. Hamas is still standing. Hamas is still exacting a price from the IDF. Palestinian resistance is resilient. This isn't what we thought we'd signed up for. We thought we were going to get total victory with American assistance. And suddenly they look around and they see that Israel's legal, political, economic vulnerabilities, which this has caused, are not being offset by the kind of grandiose schemes for accelerating the displacement of Palestinians that they thought they would get.
So, Mohammed Shahada, I want to ask you about a piece that you recently published, which was based on conversations with numerous Israeli, Palestinian, and Arab officials involved in the talks. They all expressed surprise, including the Israeli officials, that the Biden administration has continued to publicly blame Hamas as the obstacle to a ceasefire, when it was clear to all involved that it was Netanyahu who was holding up the agreement. So if you could talk about this latest development of the postponement of the cabinet vote, and also respond to the terms of the agreement that was passed yesterday, agreed upon yesterday.
Thanks so much, Nermeen, and thanks for bringing together a team of very good and close friends. Good to be here with Daniel and Jeremy. I'll start with the first issue on the terms of the agreement. It is literally word for word. I read the whole text very carefully. It's word for word, the same text as the one that was produced by Israel's own team on the 27th of May 2024, so about 7 to 8 months ago. Hamas accepted it on July 2nd. Hamas was informed by mediators that the Israeli team gave a positive response as well. Netanyahu immediately rejected it as soon as Hamas's answer was given, and imposed four conditions that his own generals, his own advisors, his own negotiators said that these conditions are impossible and render a deal unfeasible, but he insisted on them. The Biden administration immediately took a very easy approach. They decided to absolve themselves of any responsibility for refusing or failing to pressure Netanyahu by rewriting history. That's what a very senior Israeli security official told me recently in November. He said Biden's team is engaging in a shameful attempt to rewrite history, basically gaslighting, putting all blame on Hamas so that it sounds that they tried their best with Netanyahu, they got him to accept, and Hamas is to blame. The other thing is that mediators and Israel's own negotiating team have been begging Biden's team for months to name and shame Netanyahu, believing that it can create some domestic pressure on him. Biden refused consistently. We know yesterday in the Times of Israel, it came out citing Israeli negotiators that Blinken, when he used the narrative of saying Netanyahu accepted, Hamas rejected, it threw a wrench in the negotiations and collapsed them. That's what an Israeli negotiator himself said. So in a way, we had a consistent effort by Biden's team to cover up and buy time for the unfolding genocide in Gaza. The other element about what is happening now and where things stand is that Netanyahu, in the very last minute, as Daniel said, is trying to impose new conditions that would destroy the possibility of reaching a deal. His office just released a statement that negates completely the very explicitly stated terms of the appendix that was attached to the deal yesterday. For example, in the appendix, it says that the IDF should reduce its soldiers at the Philadelphia corridor that separates Rafah from Egypt throughout the first phase of the ceasefire. And they should withdraw from that Philadelphia corridor by day 50 of the ceasefire. Netanyahu is now saying, no, there would be zero reduction. No IDF post will be removed. There will be redeployment. And there will not be any withdrawal by day 50. The second point that he's insisting on is to say there will not be any ending of the war unless Hamas accepts Israel's condition to achieve the objectives of the war. What are the objectives of the war? Is that Hamas should cease to exist. So he is saying to Hamas, dismantle yourself, do exactly the job that Israel, the IDF, failed to accomplish throughout the last 15 months of genocide, of destroying Hamas's military force. Do it yourself as Hamas. Hand over your arms, surrender, bend the knee, or otherwise the war continues. And neither of these conditions were in the ceasefire agreement. So that's how he's trying to ruin it.
Let me bring Jeremy Scahill into this conversation. Jeremy, just before the ceasefire was announced yesterday, you wrote a piece on the Trump factor. Yesterday, President Biden spoke twice, right after the announcement, which also puts enormous pressure on Netanyahu, since all the world and networks are reporting there's a deal, and yet he is trying to bring together his coalition to support it. Biden spoke both in the afternoon, and he gave his farewell address from the Resolute desk in the Oval Office last night and said, this is my deal from May, though did give a nod to President-elect Trump, weighing in at the same time as if there's two governments. Explain what the difference is this time from when Biden did put this forward in May.
Well, you know, it's very clear if you read the Israeli press and listen to Israeli politicians and political leaders that this deal would not be signed, certainly not at this time, but for the intervention of Donald Trump. And much of the media coverage of Trump's threats on this were focused on Hamas, because Trump kept saying if the hostages aren't released, there's going to be hell unleashed in the Middle East. And, you know, he wasn't specifying what his threat was, but it was, you know, most of it was focused on Hamas. But what happened was that, you know, Trump's special envoy to the Middle East is not someone like an Antony Blinken or a Henry Kissinger. Instead, it's kind of, you know, like a scene from The Godfather where Tom Hagen gets sent as the consigliere to sort of do the bidding of the Don. He sends another billionaire real estate tycoon, Steve Witkoff, to the region. And Witkoff then is in the room with CIA Director Bill Burns, with Brett McGurk, the current envoy, with all of these mediators. And we understand from Israeli media coverage that last Friday, Witkoff is in Doha. He calls Netanyahu's people and says, I'm coming tomorrow to Israel, and I expect Netanyahu to be there. And they say, oh, well, no, it's Shabbat. He's not going to be able to meet with you. And Witkoff, who himself is Jewish, was like, I don't care what day it is. He arrives there and, by all accounts, sort of said, this deal is going to happen before President-elect Trump takes office. Now, some of this, I think, is true, and I don't think we can understate the role that Trump played in forcing this deal through, and it really exposes the utter moral rot that existed within the Biden White House on this issue of stopping the war, because before he even gets into office, Trump is showing the vast powers of the American presidency. He's doing it in an unorthodox way. He's doing it before he assumes office, but it just shows that Joe Biden could have ended this long ago if he used some of the levers of American power available to him, as Daniel said. This does benefit Netanyahu to an extent, because it can sort of be portrayed as, you know, Trump forced us into doing this. But the devil's in the details. Last night, Mike Waltz, Trump's incoming national security advisor, echoed something that Netanyahu has been hinting at, which is that the Israelis view this as a bitter pill that they have to swallow right now, but they're not even talking about phase two and phase three. Netanyahu really is sort of implying, and Mike Waltz co-signed that last night in interviews, that it's really just a phase one deal, and that once we get a decent number of hostages released from Gaza, then we can resume the war. Trump's national security advisor said that the aim of totally destroying Hamas and demilitarizing Gaza is a just one that the United States supports. So while Trump should be given credit for doing something that Biden and Harris systematically refused to do, this remains an extremely dangerous moment, as evidenced by the fact that Netanyahu has now ordered his forces into a full spectrum, full-scale attack against the Palestinians of Gaza leading up to Sunday. One last point, Amy, echoing some of what Mohammed and Daniel said. This narrative that Hamas has been the impediment to a ceasefire has been a lie for this entire time. From the very beginning, Hamas officials told Israeli negotiators and others that they wanted to make a deal to exchange the Israelis taken on October 7th for Palestinians being held. Anthony Blinken has been the liar in chief promoting this narrative. I was shown a document, Amy, this week that was signed by Hamas's negotiators, all of them, and it was a copy of the ceasefire agreement that Hamas's team signed and stamped on Monday. Every day after that, leading up to Wednesday, so all through the evening Monday, all through the day Tuesday, all through the day Wednesday, Antony Blinken and Israeli officials kept saying, we're just waiting on Hamas to accept the deal. I have seen proof that Hamas actually formally accepted the terms of the ceasefire on Monday, and Blinken and the Americans knew this, and they continued to feed into this lie. That's indicative of this whole story that's been going on for almost a year and a half, where a genocide has been committed against the Palestinian people, and the United States has not just serviced it with weapons and political support, but also consistently promoting lies and a narrative that ultimately was very, very lethal.
And Jeremy, if you could elaborate on why you think it is that it was so important for Trump to get this deal agreed upon. And I'd just like to read comments that a former director general of Israel's foreign ministry made earlier today, saying that this total victory for Israel, he called the ceasefire agreement a total victory for Israel, happened not in Gaza, but in Washington. Trump is seen as a total victory for Israel, has so much to benefit from Trump regarding its international status and other issues. So if you could respond, Jeremy.
Well, you know, let's remember that, you know, Trump is an unorthodox political figure. Whatever anyone thinks about him, he's an unusual character in the history of the American presidency, and he is not a creature of the Washington swamp. He may be a creature of other kinds of swamps, but he's not a creature of the Washington swamp. And so, you know, part of what is happening here, it's akin a little bit to what Ronald Reagan did to Jimmy Carter during the election in 1980 with the Iran hostage situation. It's not exactly the same, but there's some vibes of that. And I think Trump wanted to sail into his inauguration with what he could claim was like a major diplomatic victory in a war that has gone on for 16 months, and which quite likely was the defining factor that cost Kamala Harris the election against Donald Trump. On a different level, I think that you know, Trump has a much broader agenda. I don't think he particularly wants to see the Middle East in flames when he takes power. He's very, very interested in getting a normalization agreement between Saudi Arabia and Israel. I think that's one of the prizes that he's going to move toward handing Netanyahu in all of this. But there's also some really dangerous things at play that extend beyond that normalization agreement with Saudi Arabia. The West Bank. Israel wants to fully and officially annex the West Bank. Trump's number one donor, Miriam Adelson, has made very clear she wants the West Bank annexed. Mike Huckabee, the incoming U.S. ambassador to Israel, has said there's no such thing as a Palestinian, no such territory as the West Bank. So let's not pretend for a moment that Trump was motivated by humanitarian, sort of concern. But he is viewing this, I think, as a business transaction, and Trump wants capitalism in the Middle East, and he ultimately endorses an agenda that is going to be very bad for the Palestinian people. But in the short term, no question, Donald Trump was the defining factor in forcing this through.
Well, Daniel Levy, if you could respond, in fact, to that point, because a number of people have suggested that what the U.S. offered Netanyahu in return for his agreeing to the terms of the agreement is a free license to expand settlements in the West Bank.
Does anyone who says that suggest that a Trump administration, a Republican ecosystem, was going to clamp down on settlements in the West Bank? This is the point. It's a very important distinction to make, and Jeremy walked us to that distinction. It's one thing to say, and this is, I think, what we've all been saying, that Netanyahu looks at Trump and says, okay, he's the leader of a superpower. He acts like it. He's unpredictable. When my personal political interests cut across what he perceives to be the American interest of the moment, he's the top dog here. I can't do what I did with the liar in chief Blinken and the rot that is the White House, as Jeremy correctly described it. So there's a difference between that, which has changed, has upended Netanyahu's political calculation. There's a difference between that and anyone trying to depict Trump, his team, the administration, the Republican ecosystem, the evangelical dispensationalist Zionist, the Miriam Adelson donor world, between trying to depict all of those things as somehow having an agenda of Palestinian rights and liberation and ending occupation and apartheid. Of course, that would be pure silliness. But the difference here is that Israel expected to get all those things, to get an even more permissive environment when it came to violations of international law and trampling Palestinian rights on the West Bank and everywhere else, to get even more of an American lean-in to Abraham Accord-style normalization, to get an even more aggressive assault on the international legal infrastructure and architecture, like the International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice. They expected to get all of those things, but not have to deal with pesky requests on a Gaza ceasefire, because the Gaza continuation of that war and the holding of the hostages is something that irks, apparently, the incoming administration. So I think this idea that they're getting a quid pro quo is a nonsense. They're getting those things anyway. They simply expected to be able to get them and do whatever they wanted on everything else. And that's very sadly the difference when it comes to, again, this final powerful demonstration of the Biden administration in all its weakness. And let's just think about this for a moment. They've spent billions of American taxpayer dollars sending arms to Israel. They've spent other billions of American taxpayer dollars trying to secure safe shipping from the Houthis. The Houthis have told us all along this would end if you get a ceasefire in Gaza. They've spent some hundreds of millions of dollars probably in making good on just a tiny fraction of the damage done in Gaza that was caused by their original billions in weapons. All of that money until now, some have profited from that. Let's not be naive here. But all of that in order to pursue a policy that literally in a matter of days, all it took was to say, on this, no. That is shameful.
Finally, Mohammed Shahada, we give you the last word. You were born in Gaza. We're speaking to you, though, in Copenhagen. As Trump takes office and the first hostages are expected to be released, three women on Sunday, 1,000 Palestinian prisoners expected to be released in these weeks, what concerns you most about the future of the Palestinian people? We just have a minute.
Basically, what concerns me the most is that as soon as this war is going to end, Israel will impose a permanent state of non-life on Gaza, leave every Gazan with the destruction that it created for the next decades, while at the same time, Gaza and Palestine will be pushed into complete irrelevancy. Everybody's going to pretend like it doesn't exist anymore and try to force us to look the other way. So that's going to be even more painful than the war. People just suffering every day, nonstop, indefinitely, without any option or horizon.
Mohammed Shahada, we thank you for being with us. Gaza-born writer and analyst, chief of communications at Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor. Jeremy Scahill, co-founder of Dropside News, will link to your pieces. And Daniel Levy, president of the U.S. Middle East Project, former Israeli peace negotiator under two Israeli prime ministers, Ehud Barak and Yitzhak Rabin. Up next, we come back to D.C. to look at the confirmation hearing for Pam Bondi, Trump's pick to be attorney general, back in 20 seconds. Shame by Madlib. The legendary producer lost his home equipment and decades of music in the L.A. fire. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
On Thursday, six Trump nominees face Senate confirmation hearings. Senator Marco Rubio, Trump's pick for Secretary of State, John Ratcliffe for head of the CIA, Russell Vought for budget director, Sean Duffy, a climate crisis denier for transportation secretary, Chris Wright, a fracking executive, and Trump's pick for energy secretary, and Pam Bondi, Trump's nominee for attorney general. At Bondi's hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee, she avoided directly answering questions about Trump's vow to pardon January 6th defendants and refused to say Trump definitively lost the 2020 election. Bondi vowed not to politicize the Justice Department, but refused to commit to maintaining independence from Trump and his possible request to prosecute journalists or other perceived threats.
This all comes as President Biden used his farewell address in the Oval Office Wednesday night to warn Americans about growing threats to democracy. For more, we go across the country to Los Angeles to David Dayan, executive editor of the American Prospect. His recent piece is headlined Pam Bondi and the Pay-to-Play Justice System. Thanks so much for being with us, David. As you write about your adopted city in flames, let's talk about what's happening in D.C. Who is Pam Bondi? And talk about the question she was asked and her refusal to say that President Biden was, in fact, fairly elected, just said he is president and stood by that, not to mention other issues.
Yeah, Pam Bondi was the attorney general of Florida. From 2011 to 2019, after she left, she immediately became a corporate lobbyist, where she served over 30 corporate clients. During her time in office in Florida, she reversed many of her predecessors' investigations, in at least in part because they were donors to her campaign. She even stopped an investigation into Trump University, the for-profit college entity that he was using to defraud students, after she received a $25,000 gift from the Trump Foundation. So Bondi clearly has a comfort level with basing her prosecutorial discretion on whether someone has power and influence, and whether they're willing to give her a taste of that. And that's my biggest fear. Obviously, if you run the Justice Department, you have a powerful entity of the state to seek punishment against a corporate offender or any offender, or to give them a break. And the fact that she won't break with Trump, that she was a powerful surrogate for Trump on the campaign trail, that she was Trump's lawyer in 2020 in Pennsylvania looking into alleged election irregularities. That shows a real fusion between the Attorney General's office and the presidency. And, you know, Bonnie controls that department, or when she does, if she's confirmed, Trump can threaten people to get in line with his agenda under threat of some sort of punishment. And Bonnie has shown herself very willing to go along with that.
Well, David, you've gone through a list of companies that could potentially directly benefit from her position. She was, as you point out, a lobbyist for Amazon. She also lobbied for Geo Group, the private prison firm that stands to gain from Trump's immigration policy. So if you could elaborate.
Sure. There are dozens of criminal, civil, and otherwise investigations against corporations that are left over from the Biden Justice Department. And so what Pam Bondi is going to do with that is really completely up to her. Amazon is under a federal investigation by the Justice Department right now. Boeing, which engaged in deception around the 737 MAX crashes. Private prison firm CoreCivic is under a civil rights investigation right now. And Bondi was the lobbyist for Geo Group, which is their main rival. And both of those companies stand to gain from Trump's mass deportation policies. And there's a host of others, including active antitrust investigations against Apple and Google and NVIDIA and Live Nation Ticketmaster and several others, Visa among others. And so Bondi is going to have a lot of power here to decide whether or not to move forward on all of these investigations. And many of these companies under this investigation are the ones giving millions to Donald Trump's inauguration. So you can see the real conflicts of interest here. And while Bondi has sort of said that she would recuse from any investigations involving companies she personally worked for, she has not extended that to say she would recuse from investigations from the company, the lobbying firm, Ballard Partners, that she worked for. So did the Trump chief of staff, Susie Wiles. And there could be companies that have relationships with her colleagues or former colleagues that she would not recuse herself from making decisions on those. So I think it's a very dangerous situation.
I want to go back to Pam Bondi speaking on Fox News in 2023.
Department of Justice, the prosecutors will be prosecuted, the bad ones. The investigators will be investigated.
So that was Pam Bondi. The investigators will be investigated. The prosecutors will be prosecuted. David Day, and the significance of this, of not refusing to say whether she'd investigate Jack Smith, whether she'd keep an enemies list. She said there will be no enemies list, despite what the nominee for FBI is saying.
Well, it's very dangerous, and she's shown herself willing to take on prosecutors within her own department. When she was Florida Attorney General, the two highest level prosecutors who were investigating foreclosure fraud, the use of mass documents, fake documents in foreclosure cases that take people out of their homes, were working at the Florida Attorney General's office. And they were investigating someone who was Lender Processing Services, a key donor to Bondi. And so when she got into office, she fired those two high-level prosecutors. So she has no problem doing something like that. And when she says we're going to investigate the investigators and prosecute the prosecutors, this is the extension of the Trump intimidation and bullying scheme into the Justice Department, and it's the very weaponization that he decried. And her as well. So, I think it's a difficult thing.
And they kept bringing up Kash Patel, Trump's nominee for FBI, though he's supposedly independent. Not clear whether any of these people will be independent from President Trump. We have 15 seconds.
Yeah, 100%. The lack of independence is what Democrats focused on in that hearing. She kind of deflected, did not give major answers on that. And so that uncertainty continues.
David Day, an executive editor of the American Prospect, will link to your article, Pam Bondi and the pay-to-play justice system. And also,
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.